Come, Pikachu, my trusted hunchback.
My name is Gregor, Dr. Wolfenstein, and I have better posture than you.
But do you have one of these?
What is that?
I don't know. But you always see them in mad scientist movies, and I was embarrassed not to have one, and there it was, on eBay.
Is that all you wanted to show me?
For many months, Frodo, you've been asking me what I'm hiding behind that enormous metal door.
No, I haven't.
Well, at last, I am ready to show you. Behold my latest creation.
Oh my God. Dr. Wolfenstein, it's...
Yes, it's a woolly mammoth. I've harnessed the power of de-extinction.
What are we going to do with a woolly mammoth?
Why, we'll make more of them and sell them as pets. Isn't that right, Jumbo?
Who's going to want a pet that big? That thing weighs at least 10 tons.
He's sensitive about his weight.
People won't want to clean up after them.
Not a problem. Watch this. Go, Jumbo. Go and do your business in the poopy box.
He doesn't want to. I think he's going to charge us.
That's okay. All I have to do is show him this. Back, Jumbo, back.
Is that a picture of Ryan Gosling?
It is. I trained him to be terrified of Ryan Gosling from the time he was little.
You know, Dr. Wolfenstein, this isn't right. We can't be bringing back huge extinct animals and training them to be afraid of second-rate celebrities.
You know what you are, 3PO? A real buzzkill. I make this incredible thing, and you're all like, it's a big monster, it's not housebroken, this isn't the Ice Age, blah blah, woof woof. Speaking of that, can you run down to Big Y and buy all the bags of ice that they have? Jumbo's getting overheated.
I hate my job. I really hate my job.
Meanwhile, here's a show about de-extinction, featuring people who are, well, there's no nice way to put it, way behind moi on the science front. Right, Jumbo? And now, all he wants them to bring back is the milkman, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I don't even know if the milkman is technically extinct, but it seems to me we should start with him, because I miss the milkman. Now, we're going to talk today about very serious kinds of de-extinction. And yeah, everybody's mind goes to the woolly mammoth, because they're cool and people want to bring them back. But there are, as we'll be talking about today, more recently extinct species. There used to be 5 billion passenger pigeons. There are not any of them now. And there are, and that was, what, about 100 years ago or roughly that they became extinct. There are things that are even more recently extinct. So why not try to bring them back? And how close are we with the biotechnology? We've got a great group to have this conversation with today. Also, as we go along, you may have your own questions. Our number 860-275-7266. Do think that you can call in, because you can. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us and follow us on Twitter at WNPRColin. And there will be tweets going out. Possibly there will be tweets coming in as well. In studio with me, we wouldn't do a show with this like this without him. Wendell Wallach is chair of the Technology and Ethics Study Group at Yale's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. He's been following this story and this technology very closely. Also with us by phone, Carl Zimmer, science writer and columnist for The New York Times, been on our show many times, too. He wrote the cover story for the March-April issue on de-extinction for the National Geographic magazine. And lastly, by phone in Australia, where it's 3 a.m., I think, right now. Mike Archer, I don't know why I'm laughing at this poor man's sleeplessness, but Mike Archer is a professor of paleobiology at the University of New South Wales. He's a paleontologist involved in two projects to revive extinct species, including the thylacine project. I hope I'm saying that word right. And the Lazarus project. We'll tell you about the two animals in question in just a second. But let's begin. Let's sort of start. We should also say that two of our guests were speakers at a TED Talk conference that was sort of de-extinction palooza. It sort of brought everybody together to talk about de-extinction. And Carl Zimmer, you were one of the speakers there. And as we say, you wrote the cover story for National Geographic magazine on this. So in the broadest sense, how close are we? I mean, in some ways, we're not only close, we've actually seen something that was extinct be brought back, although it didn't appear to live very long. We're talking, of course, about the Bucardo. But give us a sense of how all this is working. How close are we to this being a reality?
Well, we're actually right on the verge, I'd say, of this being a reality. You mentioned the Bucardo, and that is actually a goat-like animal that lived in Spain until it became extinct a couple decades ago. And what scientists did there was they had preserved some of its cells, and they used that in a cloning experiment with goats. And after a number of failures, they were able to successfully deliver a Bucardo baby, but it quickly died right after birth. So that, you could argue, was the first de-extincted animal ever. Dr. Archer is working on a project that's, you know, also right on the verge there of actually bringing back a species that was extinct. We can also talk about some more extreme scenarios where people are talking about bringing back species that have been extinct not for years but for centuries or millennia, and no one is anywhere near making those reality.
All right, you know, let's talk to Dr. Archer. He is one of the people who seems to be close to a breakthrough on this, and he is joining us at a considerable time disadvantage. Did I get the time right? Is it 3 a.m. where you are, sir?
Oh, you want to hear me snore?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's 3 a.m., but hey, you know, when you've got an interesting topic like this, what does it matter what hour it is?
Well, as long as you feel that way, that's great. So you've got two different projects. Explain what it is you're trying to do with these two species.
Yeah, in the case of the thylacine project, which has in fact been kind of parked for the moment, I got a bee in my bonnet. I love this animal. This was Australia's king of beasts. It was a marsupial about the size of a wolf. And human beings, you know, Europeans, when they came into Australia, set about systematically destroying it. I mean, it's such a terrible story. So I think we all got a collective guilt feeling. And I saw a pickled one at one point in one of the museums here in the Australian Museum in Sydney. And in 1990, I asked the question of my geneticist colleagues, you know, hey, it's pickled in alcohol. Alcohol is a DNA preservative. Okay, technology is not there yet, but why don't we think about trying to recover DNA from that alcoholic specimen? And down the road, we'll see what we could do about possibly reconstituting it. And there were gales of laughter when I first suggested that. But I decided to try it anyway when I became director of that institution, and we did recover DNA, nuclear, mitochondrial genes. But I parked that when I left that job and took up another job. I expected my successor to continue with it, but it's still on the shelf. So I started a second project. This is called the Lazarus Project, and it's focused on a most extraordinary frog of all things that swallowed its fertilized eggs and in its stomach allowed those fertilized eggs to develop into tadpoles, and there they metamorphosed into frogs. All of this happening without being digested, and these little frogs were then burped up by the mother frog. And it got everybody so excited, but the moment particularly the medical fraternity got excited, it was suddenly extinct. So both of these frogs, or both of these animals, are things that seem to me right up at the forefront of animals we would pick in Australia to see if we could bring them back.
All right. Now, Wendell Wallach, whenever I mention to anybody that we're doing this show, everybody mentions, my mind, because I'm so lowbrow, goes immediately to the Flintstones, so we can all have extinct animals as our pets. But everybody else's mind goes to the same movie, and you all know what movie it is. We'll hear just a quick clip from it right here.
Don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Well, the question is, how can you know anything about an extinct ecosystem? And therefore, how could you ever assume that you can control it? When you have plants in this building that are poisonous, you pick them because they look good. But these are aggressive living things that have no idea what century they're in, and they'll defend themselves violently if necessary.
So my question to you, Wendell, is Has anybody talked to Jeff Goldblum and Laura Dern about this? No, that's actually not what my question for you is. My question for you is, I mean, I have millions of questions for all of you. But the first question, Wendell, is obviously the kinds of risks that they're talking about there, the kinds of issues that they're talking about there would be germane maybe if we're talking about a 4,000-year-old woolly mammoth. But for the Tasmanian tiger, the thylacine, or this unusual gastric brooding frog, we're not talking about recreating an ecosystem that hasn't been around for a really long time. These are fairly recent extinctions. So as we look at some of the ethical considerations, what are the first things that pop into your mind about how we're going to do something like this? Let's say Mike Archer has a huge, huge breakthrough tomorrow. What kinds of questions do you have at that point?
Well, I'd be thrilled if he had a huge breakthrough tomorrow, because there's a real coolness and inspirational factor in de-extinction. But there's costs, there's risks. It has a lot to do with which species you're talking about. There's many things that you would like factored in here that don't always come into the discussion. So we could spend millions of dollars de-extincting an animal, but it might be very difficult to find an environment for it that it could really thrive in, and that could at considerably more cost. There are animals that could be harbingers of pathogenic organisms that could lead to new forms of the flu, for example. But I'm not trying to bring in the scare factor. It's only that in the midst of all this inspiration and all of this coolness, is just important to factor in many of the trade-offs and risks and other concerns that have to be thought about when we look at this.
So, Mike Archer, this raises a question. Let's imagine that you did have a breakthrough and the gastric brooding frog was up and maybe ready to run, or the Tasmanian tiger, for that matter. I'm going to say that instead of thylacine, because I don't think people know what that is. The first question would be, how would you do it at the beginning? In other words, you need to make enough of them so that they can make more of them. But do you do that and have them in a very controlled environment, or do you look for an ecological niche into which you can drop them?
You know, Colin, I think one of the problems that bedevils all these discussions we often get involved in is the kind of sense that it's an either-or thing. Either you do this or you do that. So many of these things are parallel strategies. Let's say we pick the Tasmanian tiger. Certainly the first goal, and you'd have to say the noble goal here, would be to try to get a viable population back in the wild where this king of beasts can stabilize its ancient ecosystem and everybody's happy again. And there's no question in my mind, having been all over the places where it used to survive and thrive, that those environments are still there and healthy and hungry to get this animal back again. But you do more than that. You know, it's interesting that one of the last books, or most recent books, written about the Tasmanian tiger made the point that although it was illegal, there were people keeping them as pets. And in fact, it makes me weep to think that if it hadn't been illegal, we probably wouldn't have lost that animal. People would still have it, just like we look after a lot of the animals we value and bring close to us. But I think you would also have animals in zoos. I think you would also have managed breeding facilities. It wouldn't be one or the other. And if you can get one back, what we discovered when we were looking at the specimens in the Australian Museum was it wasn't just about the pickled pup. That was a little girl that had been pickled in 1866. And if that's all you could do, that would be a miracle enough, was to bring that individual back again. It's a fair question to say, well, that's a pretty blind-ended project because they can't breed and so on. But there is absolutely no reason, we now realize, that you couldn't get males from the DNA that are in male specimens in museums. You could get variation from hundreds of specimens that are in collections all over the world. Whatever you'd want to do, you could do. And even if there was an obstacle there, I mean, Bob Lanza, who's one of the sort of leading lights in this area, I love this man. He was involved, in fact, in some of the early de-extinction efforts. He said to me at one point when I said, hey, we've only got a pickled girl here, he said, don't worry about that. We get the gene for testosterone, we drop that into one of the individuals, and voila, you're going to get your male. So there's a lot of creativity here that gets over a lot of problems. Fair enough to think about the potential obstacles. But this is an exciting time to be working in this area because so many things could be done that was science fiction just 10 years ago.
And it's being suggested that by the end of this decade, the conversation that we're having right now will seem very conservative and myopic, that we will have moved so fast and so far beyond where we are right now. But, you know, Carl Zimmer, one of the things that comes up, and it's there in Wendell's comments, is, you know, obviously you don't know what happens when you drop this revived species, this de-extincted species, into an environment that has changed. But one of the other scenarios, maybe it's kind of a blue sky scenario, but it's interesting, is that a de-extincted species could, in a very positive way, change the immediate environment. I mean, that was suggested, I think, as Mike Archer used the word, destabilized its former ecosystem. And the one that comes up all the time is, let's say you did get some woolly mammoths going. They actually might be good for the permafrost. Explain that. Help people understand that idea.
Sure. So a lot of the problem we're having now with the extinctions that we're experiencing and the problems with the environment is that we're losing some key players in ecosystems. So ecosystems actually, in a lot of cases, they really seem to need top predators to stay stable. On the other hand, there are these big herbivores that can be very important for essentially engineering whole ecosystems. And so some people have argued that actually the tundra in Siberia wouldn't be a tundra if it wasn't for the loss of its great big grazing mammals, like these woolly mammoths thousands of years ago. What happens is they're grazing and they're tearing up the soil and they're fertilizing it in huge volumes, if you can imagine what I'm talking about. And in any case, what you would have then would be a grassland, which would have all sorts of benefits, including actually being able to hold on to more carbon. So some people have argued that that actually bringing back some of these extinct species to these ecosystems would actually be a good thing. It wouldn't just be, you know, assuaging or guilt or something like that, that actually a lot of our ecosystems are kind of limping along because we have been pulling out key parts of them. And so this would be one way to restore them. I mean, we're trying to restore ecosystems in other ways. I mean, that's why wolves are being brought back to places in the American West where they used to be, in the hopes that they can control some of these herbivores to then have positive effects on other parts of their ecosystems. So it's all part of the same idea.
You know, Wendell, obviously there's a wow factor with some of the things that we talk about with a woolly mammoth or something like that. From an ethical point of view, from a bioethicist's point of view, is there some kind of moral incumbency to work first with the species that we are responsible for exterminating and the species also that have been around more recently? I mean, everybody wants a woolly mammoth, but, you know, the heath hen was driven into extinction in the 1930s. You know, should that come back first?
Well, there's certainly people who argue that those should come back first. There's people who are going to argue that the very project is another one of these examples of tinkering with nature, as if that the species that we have totally wiped out through our own shotguns should, you know, we have sort of a guilt complex and we have to bring them back. But perhaps it was also God's intent that they should disappear. But I think there is no clear-cut bioethical position that should say we should bring back these species or those species. I think the bigger bioethical concerns are, in that process, what are going to be the trade-offs, costs, and risks, and which species should we focus on? Because clearly there are going to be people going down this path.
Mike, I'm assuming that when you're making a case for money and resources for your projects, you say there is some kind of imperative to deal with these species whose blood is essentially on our hands.
Yeah, I did start out that way, but I have to say, you know, I'll be completely honest here, that it was a very convenient rationale also for focusing on those animals. But I'd have to admit, I was obsessive, as many people are, about the Tasmanian tiger. I mean, it's like if Asia lost tigers, it's as iconic an animal as that. It's Australia's mammoth, if you like. So. But it wasn't hard, given that important role that they played ecologically, to say that, you know, we do have a moral imperative. I actually genuinely feel that we do. If we can bring that back, I would say that would have a high priority, particularly if bringing it back can have other beneficial effects. And in that particular case, what's interesting is we're in danger in Australia of losing the next most iconic animal, or marsupial here, and that's the Tasmanian devil. This is the thing Warner Brothers turned into this demon, this whirling dervish that used to chase Bugs Bunny around the place. They're actually beautiful, gentle animals, about the size of a collie dog, or a little smaller than that. And this animal is in danger of dying of a communicable cancer that they can get from nibbling each other. And it turns out that the reason that disease could exterminate that whole species is we've killed the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, which used to compete with it and keep its populations limited, so that if a disease did start out in one corner of the island of Tasmania where it lives, it wouldn't spread across the whole population. Now, if we could get that Tasmanian tiger back again, it would restore that balance, and the current threat of extinction that Tasmanian devil is under would be eliminated. So, you know, we may need to do this in order to save another iconic species.
Although it might be a hard sell with the Tasmanian devils. You know, really, if we get the Tasmanian tiger back to eat you, you guys are going to be so much better. You're going to love this. Well, you know, Wendell, another ethical consideration is to the animals themselves. So we talked about the Bucardo. You know, Carl explained what was attempted there, and then this thing died what was probably a pretty agonizing death, which, you know, raises that question too. I mean, to what degree is it fair, is it okay to experiment with these animals when, in fact, some whole other grisly set of things may wind up happening to them?
Yes, I think this is a particularly important point that you're bringing up here. You know, we jumped to this conclusion that we're going to have 150,000 woolly mammoths back in the tundra regions and they're going to save us from global warming. But the fact is, to get from here to there isn't just a question of even the science or genetic engineering. It's really how successful, how much failure, what kind of pain will happen between here and there. Will the creature we actually get be the creature that disappeared? I mean, there are technical issues here about the fact that an elephant is going to have to carry this the DNA from a woolly mammoth. It's in a very, right away, the environment within that cell is a different environment than in the cell of the actual woolly mammoth. That elephant is going to have to raise that woolly mammoth. So I'm just using this as an example of some of the kind of problematics that happen that raise questions about whether on the other side we really have a viable species or even have reincarnated exactly the species that we had intended to reincarnate.
Yeah, we're going to take a break in just a second, and then I want to come back and talk to Carl and to Michael about some of the considerations that you're talking about right now. But before we go to break, Carl Zimmer, I feel like you're entitled to also nominate a species to bring back one of our extinct species. And I know that you actually have one in mind that under ideal circumstances would be nice to bring back. So tell us about that.
Well, I'm sort of feeling conflicted these days. For a long time, I said stellar sea cows because they're these sort of manatees on steroids, like 20 or 30 feet long. They were in the North Pacific until a couple centuries ago. But I'd really like to see the elephant bird again. That stood about 9 feet tall and weighed 600 pounds in Madagascar. And it was around just a few centuries ago. And I think both of them would be amazing to see again in their habitats.
All right. Yeah, it's amazing how many of the extinct animals are also really cool looking. It's frustrating. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more of this after this.
I recall the time they found those fossilized mosquitoes, and before long they were cloning DNA. Now I'm being chased by some irate velociraptors. Well, believe me, this has been one lousy day.
We're back. We're talking about de-extinction. If you have questions or perhaps your own animal that you want to bring back, give us a call at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. you may tweet us and be tweeted at WNPRColin. Our guests are Carl Zimmer, science writer and columnist for The New York Times. He wrote the cover story for the March-April issue, National Geographic Magazine, about de-extinction. Mike Archer's on the line with us from Australia, where it is 3 a.m. in the morning. It's 3:32 now, actually. And he's a professor of paleobiology at the University of New South Wales. He's a paleontologist involved with two projects to revive extinct species. Wendell Wallach's here in the studio with me, where it's not 3 a.m. He's the chair of Technology and Ethics Study Group at Yale's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. So, Carl Zimmer, I want to sort of touch on something that Wendell was kind of alluding to, I think. I'm sure there's more than two, but there's at least two ways to think about all this. One of them is the Mike Archer way. Let's get a Tasmanian tiger back. Let's get a lot of Tasmanian tigers back so they can stabilize their habitat and have things more or less as they were, or do the same thing with the gastric brooding frog. But the other sort of de-extinction strain that I'm aware of is a little bit more of a fusion thing, right? There are attempts being made right now to breed cattle in a way that preserves or revives some of the characteristics of the auroch, which was a kind of wild ox that died out in the 17th century. So are those sort of two different theories of de-extinction, sort of get the whole animal back, or get something that was kind of like the old animal?
Yeah, there are turned out to be a lot of different ways to approach this, at least conceptually. So Mike Archer is, in the position where he's actually got those whole cells with their DNA intact from this extinct species, and that's a very rare situation. So you mentioned the auroch, which is this kind of wild cow-like animal that was in Europe until a few centuries ago. So what some people would like to do is breed existing cattle for the traits that aurochs had, and the thinking being that you could basically breed back an auroch, in other words, combine genes and maybe get something that's behaves and looks a lot like aurochs did and sort of fulfill that role. It wouldn't be exactly the same genetically speaking as the aurochs were, but that for them, they don't see that as being something to make a big fetish over. This is an issue when you're talking also about even older species where you don't have really any close living relatives and you don't have any intact DNA. In those cases, what people want to do is actually retrieve bits of DNA and basically figure out what its genome was like and then engineer the cell of a living species to basically have a lot of the genetic characteristics of that very old species, like a woolly mammoth, for example.
Mike Archer, you're talking about frogs and Tasmanian tigers. Inevitably, conversations come up about birds that were missing, heath hens and passenger pigeons and things like that, great auks and dodos. I may be about to reveal how incredibly ignorant I am about this, although I hope to conceal it for an entire hour. But I get the feeling that birds are different and they're more difficult because once you get an egg, you're kind of off and rolling with a bird, whereas you can tinker with a so-called egg in a mammal. True, false?
Yeah, it is actually true. I mean, I don't think any of these things are impossible, but some are relatively more difficult than others to sort of go down these paths. And certainly, one of the problems with birds is that their embryos don't implant in a uterus so that you get lots of access and you can manage their development and tinker with the embryo. So those people are actually working with recovered DNA. That's how the passenger pigeon is working. And the idea is to then take the segments as you recover them from the museum specimens or, in some cases, even more extinct things. If we are going to get the Madagascan rock back, which I agree with Carl would be fantastic, you'd be recovering bits of DNA and then splicing that into the DNA of a reasonably close living relative or even replacing the section of DNA that you realize it represents. And so you would be steadily trying to convert the genome of one animal to become more and more like the genome of the extinct animal. So it is a little harder. And Carl's right and that we've kind of had it easy. And in the case of the gastric brooding frog, we've recovered cells with, as far as we can see, all of the DNA inside each of those cells. So we're almost cheating it so easy. But this will be the same thing for the Bucardo. If that works, that's because we Alberto, the wonderful man who's working with that project, is able to recover whole nuclei from the tissues of Celia, the last Bucardo that died. So these other projects are more challenging, but I don't think there's any reason not to try to go down this path. And as technology gets better and better and the sequencing machines get absolutely brilliant in being able to understand every part of the recovered DNA and how to start to assemble the genome from fragments, we get closer and closer to the time when reconstituting an ancient genome from fragmentary material will be possible.
You know, Wendell Wallach, listening to Mike Archer talk, I think that, well, as a bioethicist, part of your job is when people start talking about this and technology is getting better and better, sequencing machines are moving faster and faster. Inevitably, the question is our planetary wisdom keeping pace with biotechnology? It sounds as though we're, in the middle of another sort of explosive time with genomic sequencing. So, before we started the show, you were saying that when the movie Jurassic Park came out, people like you sat there and went, well, nothing like that is ever happening. Well, that's not actually happening. That's currently still impossible. But things that are possible seem every bit as amazing. And I guess in a more overarching sense, is biotechnology moving so fast that it's hard to ask the right questions about it in time?
I believe it is. I believe we're at a major inflection point, and genomics is one of the crucial drivers of that. The ability to alter the genome is perhaps one of the major turning points in human history. And we're at an inflection point where what the technology can do is way ahead of our ability to reflect seriously upon it and make informed decisions about what should be embraced, what should be regulated, what should perhaps even be relinquished. And it's also important to understand that this project is not isolated from much broader research in genomics. So it's going to move along questions about designer babies, and it's going to move along questions about creating totally new synthetic organisms that also will compete to be introduced into environments. And though the dangers may be different than the recreation of a species that has disappeared, there are fundamental questions about whether we can reintroduce vast numbers of species into the environments without really upsetting the environments we have.
Carl, I want you to say a little bit about that, too. If we are that close to bringing back an extinct species, what else are we close to that the average person can't really grasp right now?
Well, we are certainly really close to being able to manipulate our own biology with some of the same tools that are being explored for de-extinction. There are some new methods for altering DNA, for example, that are proving to be incredibly powerful and precise. People have talked about how we might be able to tinker with DNA, but the tools that people used for things like, for example, gene therapy have been pretty relatively simple and have come with a lot of challenges. And in a lot of cases, the results haven't been great. But there are some new methods. One is called CRISPR, which are frighteningly precise. And so, not only could you tinker around with the DNA sequence of some extinct species to make it better able to survive today, conceptually, we could start tinkering around with people's DNA. The first thing would be to help people with genetic disorders. If a child is going to die by the age of 5, unless you tinker with their DNA, I think there's going to be a strong incentive to push that forward. But then where do you go from there? Do you do sort of preventive DNA tinkering? Do you want to just get rid of that little mutation in your genome that's slowing you down? We're going to have to think seriously about these things because these are probably going to be happening really soon.
All right. Our number is 860-275-7266. I'm going to pop Carl on hold for a second so I can bring George from Ellington up here. He's about to introduce a subject that I wanted to bring up with Mike Archer and the other panelists anyway. So, George, what's on your mind?
I have read that toward the last of the change from the last ice age into our present climate, there have been remains of fossils from the woolly mammoth found, which would indicate that it is not only mankind's hunting, but the rapid change of climate over the course of the last few years that...
Are you with us, George? I think he's disappeared. Well, he's pointing towards something I wanted to point towards anyway, and I think I know where he was going with that question. So one issue, Mike Archer, is we're certainly facing, you know, enormous challenges right now with climate change. We have some species that are on the brink of extinction anyway, climate change or otherwise. I mean, that just sort of happens. Species become extinct all the time. But because of climate change and other factors, we might be on the verge of mass extinctions, you know, one of these people talk about the sixth mass extinction. So with a brilliant guy like you, why wouldn't we want you working on addressing some immediate needs having to do with either species that are about to go extinct or the possibility of mass extinctions? Why work on a Tasmanian tiger or a gastric brooding frog, given all the stuff that seems to be about to happen in our world right now?
Yeah, those are only very powerful questions. I mean, I don't think anybody's in any doubt that we are, in fact, triggering the sixth Earth's mass extinction event, and we're responsible for that. And the way we're changing climates, we're obliterating the way traditional lands are used, we're wiping out biodiversity. I mean, it's gotten to the ridiculous point now where wildlife is no longer safe in the wild. But I think in the case of let's stick with the mammoth, because that's a very, very charismatic animal to think about. It is interesting that the people who are focused on this, and they want to establish what's called Pleistocene Park, and I love the idea. They've already established all the land. They bought huge tracts of land. And their argument is a powerful one connected with climate change. Under the Siberian tundra is one of the worst substances that's able to drive climate change in a way that should frighten us. They're called clathrates. They're frozen methane. And right now, as the world is warming up because of our activities of burning fossil fuels, those clathrates are beginning to melt. They've been frozen until now. And as they melt, they put a gas into the atmosphere that's nearly 20 or 30 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And the people who want to establish Pleistocene Park are saying, if we can get large animals back there, if we could reestablish that ecosystem in the way that it was there, cycling through the Pleistocene from one glacial period to the interglacial period, we can stabilize and slow down the release of those clathrates and slow down this awful trend of global warming, which is going to cost so many more species their lives. So I think a lot of the de-extinction efforts that are going on are not just about trying to stabilize ecosystems and bring back species to add to biodiversity. They're also developing technologies that are going to be extremely important in helping to conserve endangered species today, even gene swapping, even discovering how you could use the cells of an endangered animal and get them mass-produced as embryos in a non-endangered relative. So these technologies are all interwoven. De-extinction isn't working in isolation. It's part of a technology that's going to have beneficial applications in all directions, and some of that may include slowing down climate change.
All right. We're going to continue with this part of the conversation and also questions about moral hazard and all kinds of stuff. We want to hear from you, too, 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at WNPR Colin. Let's take our break, and we'll be right back. He just wants to have some fun and walk the forest floor till a big old woolly mammoth come and chase him to his door. When you see a woolly coming at you just like thunder, get you moving fast to hide, or woolly's got your number.
Finally arrived, my partially fossilized giant sloth dung. I can extract the DNA and make a... Whew, I didn't realize it would smell that bad. I probably should have tipped the FedEx guy. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Anna Novak and Tess Aronson. Greg Hill appeared in the introduction and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jeff Goldblum. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff making spicy cavatelli with woolly mammoth meatballs, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, what TV meteorologists think about climate change. And now, back to Colin.
All right, yes. Our shows this week link in a very interesting kind of chain. And so tomorrow we are going to talk specifically about climate change. The theory being that you get a lot of your information, probably the only real sort of conversations, and they're one-sided conversations you have all week long, are with somebody on television telling you what the weather's going to be. That's who you either come to trust or perhaps mistrust, depending on how their predictions come out. But what do they actually think about climate change? You know, usually when there have been studies in the past, a lot of meteorologists don't really line up with the climatological community about what climate change is or whether it exists or not. So tomorrow you'll meet some of your favorite TV meteorologists, but in a whole new context. All right, so we're talking right now about de-extinction. So Wendell Wallach, you know, when we have these kinds of conversations, of course, one of the things that we hope is that in all the ways that that Mike Archer just described, people will handle all this stuff responsibly, and that our attitudes towards these de-extincted species will be attitudes of reverence. But there's a lot of evidence on hand to support the idea that that won't necessarily be the case, that we're pretty cavalier and casual, at least as a race, as a human race, about species. I mean, you and I and Carl live in a state where the legislature just a few days ago passed a law allowing the commercial fishing of glass eels, which we know are hovering on the brink of extinction. And one possibility, a sort of moral hazard possibility here, is that if Mike Archer and other scientists break through on all this stuff, people will go, oh, well, then we don't really have to worry about driving species to extinction because Michael just makes some new ones for us.
This has been a particular concern within the environmental community because there's this feeling that we're going to be able to solve not just this question of extinct species, but all of our problems through technological solutions. I think the one that Mike points out in regards to the woolly mammoth is a well-taken one and perhaps one of the most specific ones that might justify reincarnating the woolly mammoth. But when you talk about trying to save other species, there is a kind of cavalier attitude that it may not matter anymore if we're able to de-extinct them down the line. And yet the fact is it's going to be very expensive. Even as technology gets cheaper and cheaper, it's going to be very expensive to de-extinct many species. And the money spent on that could perhaps save many of the species that that we're cavalierly losing at a fantastic rate.
You know, Carl, as you've talked to a lot of the scientists working on this, and one of the other questions that comes up sometimes is, on the one hand, it's a question of making more of something that doesn't exist anymore. But those things, whatever they are, let's take passenger pigeons because there used to be a lot of them. The passenger pigeons, I would assume, were not simply a species, but they kind of were a civilization, right? They had social behaviors. There were billions and billions of passenger pigeons who were coexisting somehow. And our scientists thinking about, this is also a good question for Mike, but I'll start with you, Carl. Are scientists thinking about that? I mean, if you make new ones, do they necessarily know how to be, so to speak?
Well, that's a great question. Singling out extinct species is kind of I don't think is the right way to go about addressing this, because we already have to deal with that when we're dealing with endangered species that we're trying to build up again. We know that you have to take into account the social behaviors of all sorts of species where you're trying to rear them in captivity, because they're not going to have the same cues as they would if they were growing up in the wild. So you don't want animals that you're raising in a zoo to kind of get used to having people around, for example. You want them to be scared of people and so on. And so conservation biologists are already dealing with all of these issues with the species that they already have. And it's tough. It's really hard to, you know, raise a California condor so it goes off and it's like something like the way condors used to be. There's no doubt that that would be a big part of the challenge, but it's already a challenge.
A California condor that's been being fed by hand puppets. They just go off and look for more hand puppets. I'm going to do this little trick that I have where I put Carl briefly on hold. I'm certainly not messing around with the connection to New South Wales here. And here's Katie from Newington with a question. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I guess this kind of goes along with what you were just saying about 2 seconds ago, with the preservation of endangered species. And I guess I just want to kind of talk on how spending money and whatnot on preserving endangered species when really, I mean, we could just bring them back a little bit later. We can fix things in the future. Where is that type of research going to go? Do we continue to focus on the endangered species or kind of let that lapse a little bit and then hopefully we'll be able to bring them back when we know there's a better environment for them, predators are gone, certain things like that.
All right. Mike, you're the one who hasn't really had a chance to weigh in entirely on this. And, part of the question she's asking, too, I think, is, there's scientists who believe in scientists in science and do their scientific work, but ultimately a political structure gets involved, too. And so it's hard enough, at least here in the United States, to get politicians to take climate change seriously. And so one of the questions would be, is this kind of technology going to make people even more cavalier about risks to various forms of life?
I don't actually think so. There's so many points that have been raised that are so interesting here. One of them certainly is the cost of actually pursuing this parallel strategy. And I stress again, it's not a question of focusing on trying to get a mammoth back or alternatively using all of the money to try to conserve elephants. We can do both. My experience is that the people who want to help with de-extinction projects are putting new money on the table that they otherwise simply had no interest in putting into conservation. They're interested because of the technology involved. So the two projects I'm involved in have people investing in them, and it's a very small amount of money. At the end of the day, we've gone all this way recovering genomes for these two animals and getting embryos of the gastric brooding frog, and I haven't even spent $50,000 at this point, not even half a salary of one person, to do that over the space of 4 or 5 years. So it's not that expensive for some of these kinds of projects, and that money would not otherwise be going into conservation. But in terms of convincing politicians that these are good things to do, even if it is private money that tends to be helping these projects along, boy, you put your finger on a problem there. I mean, you may think you've got problems in the United States, but we've just got a government here in Australia that virtually, the word BS that we're not allowed to say over the radio, they declare that climate change is all BS. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to do anything about it. So all around the world, getting governments to understand that 97-98% of scientists are saying this is a serious problem we have to deal with, and we have to deal with it now, or it is going to cost many more species than we can even begin to think about. We have to do this. I don't know what the solution here is, but we are definitely dangerously far down that sixth great mass extinction, and we're doing it. De-extinction is just one arrow in the quiver of biologists and conservationists trying desperately to maintain biodiversity while our politicians are busy doing everything they can to ignore the problem and let it just get hugely worse.
Well, this is, as Betsy just suggested, a great lead into tomorrow's show. And I dare not ask any of you another question because my time is so short. So what I'm going to do is instead I'm going to profusely thank you, Wendell Wallach, Chair of Technology and Ethics Study Group at Yale's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics, Mike Archer, joining us from New South Wales, where he is a professor of paleobiology and involved in two projects to revive extinct species, Carl Zimmer, science writer and columnist for The New York Times, and most pertinently, author of the cover story in the March-April issue of National Geographic about de-extinction. Come back and join us tomorrow. It really does sort of flow into this. We'll be talking about climate change, and we'll be talking about it with the people that you depend on to find out whether you need an umbrella tomorrow.
Kion Wolf with the newly recreated saber-toothed tiger. Well, looks like it's gone extinct again, but definitely not from any man-made reason.